9. Progressive Socialist Marxist Politics. From ITS birth in 1963, the Institute for Policy Studies has operated on the basis of an image of the United States as being a national security state that is controlled by greedy corporations supporting a militarized regime that pursues a global imperialist agenda. The U.S., therefore, is seen as the world's greatest threat to peace and a pillager of the economies and environments of developing countries. The Institute for Policy Studies has carried out wide-ranging propaganda and disinformation attacks against U.S. power and its global network of alliances and cooperators, including commentary aimed at the destruction of the public consensus, supporting defense spending, NATO, and other military alliances, the CIA, FBI, and military intelligence agencies. The Heritage Foundation writes that the Institute's founders hoped to have an impact upon governmental policy and hoped that this impact would be a radical one. This unbending hate of America and dedication to tearing down the government, not reform, lies at the base of the Institute for Policy Studies' radicalism. The rhetoric of IPS publications is always couched in radical terms, bespeaking a fundamental dissatisfaction with the very basis of American society and government. The rhetoric of IPS leaders reveals an essentially revolutionary perspective of American society, an outright rejection, if one prefers, of our society, our government, and our economic system. This IPS radicalism sets the foundation for focusing sharply on a question left open by S. Stephen Powell in Covert Cadre, 1987. As previously quoted, Powell wrote that there is a consistency between the way IPS operates and the revolutionary activity advocated by Antonio Gramsci. For both, it is important to infiltrate autonomous institutions, schools, media, churches, public interest groups, so as radically to transform the culture, which determines the environment in which political and economic policies are played out. Or, as Karl Box, one of IPS's shining stars and author of Gramsci's Marxism, wrote, the role of revolutionary theory is to create the foundation of a new socialist order precisely through the negation and transcendence of bourgeois society. This transcendence of bourgeois society, Boggs explains, was the basis for Gramsci's first priority, the multidimensional transformation of civil society. The key to Gramsci's formula for revolution centered on the idea of breaking what he called the hegemony or mind control exercised by the ruling capitalists over the masses. Bourgeois societies were ruled, Gramsci believed, by educating the citizenry that their accommodation of the moral, political, and cultural values defined by the governing system was in their best interest. 5. Hence, Gramsci designed a reversal strategy that would silently challenge the existing culture and value systems that dominated bourgeois governance. That is to say, his formula was based on an ideological struggle that would transform a whole range of activities in civil society, including Judeo-Christian values, the family, schools, unions, and politics and popular trust in the existing government. It followed, according to Karl Box, that the main political task of a socialist movement then is to create a counter-hegemony to break the ideological bond between the ruling class and various sectors of the general population. The radical political program prosecuted by the Institute for Policy Studies since its inception has been a solar system of progressive socialist Marxist organizations that are conducting a counter-hegemony campaign against the American culture, economy, and government through the use of its multiple collaborator shining stars, triggering a cultural revolution that rewires American values and transforms the political system could assure the left sufficient mind control to accede to power. In Gramsci's view, class domination is exercised as much through popular consensus achieved in civil society as through physical coercion, or threat of it, by the state apparatus, where education, the media, law, mass culture, etc. take on a new role. 7. Or, to put it another way, there are 10 steps toward an American progressive socialist Marxist civil society. Change the popular consensus by destroying Christianity, the traditional family, and existing social mores. Transform the culture by installing a radical left mind control. Attain political power by imposing strict control of the military and law enforcement. Restrict freedom by socializing the economy. Erase American sovereignty by embracing a world without borders. Attain political power by winning democratic elections, dominate both houses of Congress, impose strict control of the military and law enforcement, restrict freedom of the press and expression, enforce a massive redistribution of wealth from the private and public sector, limit freedom of speech, religion, right to bear arms, and states' rights, socialize the economy, and erase American sovereignty to make way for a world without borders. For political arenas have been constructed by the progressive socialist Marxist left to format or erase America's collective brain and install a mind control program that will produce a compliant robotic America of theological radicalism. Socialist unionism or syndicalism, radical community state politics, and the shadow party owned and operated by billionaires and millionaires inside the Democrat Party. Theological radicalism. Antonio Gramsci's formula for socialist revolution in capitalist countries is focused on corruption of their Christian cultural basis, Martin writes. Neither political penetration nor military superiority, Martin says, will bring the capitalist West to its knees. The Christian cultures of these countries are the ties that bind the people in all aspects of society. Hence, Gramsci counsels his followers, Martin says, to join the capitalists in all aspects of life, from their profession of ethical and religious goals to their family needs and all social issues affecting their lives. But Gramsci had a catch, Malachi Martin explains. Gramsci admonished his followers to let the entire effort be solely by man for man's sake. Make sure man never repeats the famous cry of German philosopher Martin Heidegger, "I know that only God can save us." Gramsci's writings also reflected his sensitivity to the intimacy between what is known as common sense and religion. Hence, Gramsci realized that Christian culture had to be undone quietly, carefully, and over time. Stealth and passivity would serve as key principles of the war on Christian culture and open the door for progressive socialist Marxist mind control. The late Richard Barnett, an IPS co-founder, reached out to tap Christian compassion and moral authority as a force for political change. His focus was on how man, not God, could influence the wicked world created by man, and, in particular, the principal source of evil, the United States. Addressing the dangers of mankind's arms race and the need for man to create a world community of caring interdependence, Barnett warned that humankind is entering a period of unique opportunity and unprecedented danger. Barnett's work with the faith-based group, World Peacemakers, led them to distribute 40,000 copies of his scripture about nuclear dangers, A Time to Stop, and why readers should join the anti-nuclear movement. Later, with other religious entities, the World Peacemakers adopted the covenant, "In the name of God let us, humankind, abolish nuclear weapons." For Maine faith-based, theological radicals have long-standing strategic alliances with the Institute for Policy Studies. The World Council of Churches, WCC, promotes Christian unity as its primary mission and has long been involved in global disarmament activism. The WCC is not a church but an organization that promotes the fellowship of churches and common statements and actions around the world and maintains a UN liaison office in New York. The effort to curb the proliferation of arms is seen by members of the council to be a part of their ecumenical commitment to overcome violence and to build a culture of peace. The membership is made up of roughly 550 million Christians represented through some 350 churches of at least 25,000 members, denominations and fellowships, except the Roman Catholic Church, in 120 countries and territories throughout the world. Among those churches are Anglican, Lutheran, Methodist, Orthodox, Baptist, Evangelical, Presbyterian, Episcopal, Moravian, Mennonite, Pentecostal, and several others. The World Council of Churches and the Roman Catholic Church maintain a close relationship. A joint working group meets annually. The Russian Orthodox Church was penetrated by the Soviet KGB and used ecumenicism to promote Soviet policies during the Cold War. The Soviets also set up a church front called the Christian Peace Conference, which included church members from the Eastern Bloc along with Protestant clergy in the West that supported Soviet aims. The controlling KGB officer was Alexei S. Yuzhevsky. He also served on the WCC Executive Committee. When the Russian Orthodox Church and Eastern Bloc churches joined the WCC in 1961, the Kremlin took control of the World Council. These events explain why so much of the WCC's disarmament program during the Cold War was directed against the West, while the Soviet Union was depicted as a hapless victim of aggression. In November 1981, the WCC held an international hearing on nuclear weapons in Amsterdam, where Cora Weiss, then holding the disarmament chair at the Riverside Church in New York, offered some specific recommendations that would use the WCC as a left-wing political front to collect money for the peace movement from unsuspecting churchgoers. The Transnational Institute and the WCC founded the Transnational Information Exchange, TIE, in 1978. By the mid-1980s, TIE had some 130 affiliates worldwide, from Europe to Latin America and Asia. These partners addressed what they described as a transnational corporation problem. Among the cutting-edge anti-corporate groups in the TIE were research entities, workers' organizations, trade unions, labor research centers, shop stewards' committees, third world groups, church organizations, and local government and economic planning centers. Corporate workers often spied on their employer, providing inside information to TIE analysts. The WCC's links with the Socialist International and the Radical Anti-Corporate Network is reflected by its periodic contributions to the TIE through its Christian Medical Commission to the Transnational Institute, which often fed corporate information to the Institute for Policy Studies. The National Council of Churches of Christ in the USA, NCC, founded in 1950, is a community of 36 Protestant, Anglican, and Orthodox communions, as well as Black and historic Christian denominations. The council represents 45 million members through its subscriber churches. The General Assembly, which brings together nearly 300 representatives, is the NCC's highest policy-making body. A smaller executive board meets several times a year to act on behalf of the General Assembly. The NCC's members conduct humanitarian actions in more than 80 countries, including the United States. The NCC building in New York is right across from the Riverside Church and connected by a tunnel and maze of underground pathways. The NCC works with many ecumenical and interfaith organizations, including working relationships with the Roman Catholic Church, evangelical, and Pentecostal communities and other Christian bodies. The NCC's traditional political focus has been placed on poverty and war. The U.S. NCC adopts a double standard of taking a position that it can only influence and resolve in its own society. Thus, the United States is placed under the glare of being seen as an oppressor, while other countries get a free pass for often terrible, murderous actions. In the NCC view, Rael Jean and Eric Isaac write in The Course of Utopians, social determinism applies only to the poor and minorities. Those higher on the social scale possess freedom, responsibility, culpability, and should go to jail. The NCC adopted a similar peculiar twist on U.S. arms sales in that it does not blame Arab and other countries with oil revenue sufficient to buy them. Rather, the NCC joins its progressive socialist Marxist allies in blaming the United States and transnational corporations for selling the weapons. In the final analysis, Rael Jean and Eric Isaac's 2001 conclusion remains valid. The NCC looks upon the United States as an oppressor, both at home and abroad. The NCC joined the Institute for Policy Studies in efforts to shape U.S. foreign and defense policies, especially in Latin America. The North American Congress on Latin America, NACLA, for instance, enjoyed funding from the NCC while coordinating its political activities with IPS. Originally conceived in 1966 by the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, as the intelligence-gathering arm of the New Left, NACLA soon became a primary source of information on revolutionary guerrilla movements in Latin America. Thanks to NCC support and its provision of office space, the NACLA Research Group proudly described itself as an intelligence operation for revolutionary movements in Latin America. The defeat of Nazi Germany and Japan in 1945, combined with the subsequent threat of the Soviet Union, demanded new foreign policies by the Roman Catholic Church. By and large, the pontiffs over the next four decades or so were cold warriors insofar as they supported the Western powers against the godless Soviet communists, though an intense concern was reflected on human rights, economic justice, and international order. Pope John Paul II differed from previous papal policies by engaging world leaders directly, discussing power of the state and how it should be used. It almost got him killed when a Turk, Mehmet Ali Hakka, shot him four times in Rome on May 13, 1981. According to Polish journalist John O. Kohler, a KGB contract killing warrant on John Paul II was signed by Mikhail Gorbachev in November 1979. Pope John Paul II, though despising communism, did not fully embrace the free market. He subscribed to capitalism only so long as democracies and market economies were disciplined sufficiently for humanity to flourish. Major elements of American organized labor have not only imported the alien doctrine of Antonio Gramsci as a guiding light for its socialist ideological struggle against the traditional American way of life, but also imported another foreign doctrine, syndicalism, most popular historically in France and Spain. In its shirt sleeves, syndicalism is a socialist doctrine dedicated to transforming capitalist societies through working class political action on the labor front, including through strikes, sabotage, and terrorism. For American progressive socialist Marxist syndicalists, labor unions are a tool for use in transforming capitalism into a society run by working people who are guided secretly by agents among the leadership. Labor federations, according to their plan, would run industry and the workplace as well as government in a socialist society. It should not be surprising, therefore, that organized labor in the United States has shifted its main focus from the worker and her needs to progressive socialist Marxist politics. For union leadership, their efforts are all about power, power for themselves, social power, and political power. Five U.S. labor unions stand out from their efforts of making socialist politics possible at the mass level by applying the imported ideals of Italy's Marxist Antonio Gramsci and France's and Spain's socialist syndicalism, AFL-CIO. Service Employees International Union, SEIU, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSEM, National Education Association, NEA, and American Federation of Teachers, AFT. Of these five leading unions, only the members of the AFL-CIO operate primarily in the private sector. The other four are centered more on government employees, insulating themselves from the vagaries of the free market. The safety of operating on the taxpayers' nickel gives the public service unions freedom to pursue progressive socialist Marxist politics to transform America's liberal democracy, while taking a free ride on the productive economy. The move toward embracing Gramsci's formula and union syndicalism is a result of the 1960s radicals having come of age. The late Michael Harrington gave intellectual and organizational leadership to labor unions and other societal elements that preserved an alliance with the remnants of the New Left and the Democrat Party and Democratic Socialists of America. SDS's Paul Booth, for instance, coordinated student support for a United Auto Workers slate and marshaled some 2,000 students in the Chicago region in support of the union. Booth, like other leftists, highlighted General Motors' nastiness. One can track members of the 1960s radicals, Students for a Democratic Society, and the New Left into key leadership positions in several labor and teachers' union positions. These aging radicals have not given up on remaking America. A new politics must include a revitalized labor movement, a movement which sees itself, and is regarded by others, as a major leader of the breakthrough to a politics of hope and vision, explains the 1962 Port Huron Statement of the Students for a Democratic Society. Labor's role is no less unique or important in the needs of the potential political strength, its natural interest in the abolition of exploitation, its reach to the grassroots of American society, combined to make it the best candidate for the synthesis of the civil rights, peace, and economic reform movements. Yesterday's socialist Marxist revolutionaries may wear suits and ties and pantsuits four decades later, but these ideologues who were thoroughly immersed in Germany's critical theory, Italy's revisionist Marxism, Antonio Gramsci, and France's and Spain's syndicalism have not given up. Their power in the 2000s is political power drawn from organized labor. The American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations, AFL-CIO, is affiliated with more than 50 unions representing some 10 million people. John Sweeney is president of the AFL-CIO. His labor organization background began in 1960 when he was hired as a contract director for a New York City local of the Service Employees Union International, SEIU. Right from the beginning at the top post in the AFL-CIO, Sweeney made no secret of his desire to advocate European-style democratic socialism. He also opened the union's doors to the Communist Party, USA. Following the AFL-CIO's 1996 convention, the late American communist leader Gus Hall said that the radical shift in both leadership and policy is a very positive, even historic change. Sweeney is a card-carrying member of the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, which is the principal American affiliate of the Socialist International. In the Sweeney era, the same Marxist notions that characterize the DSA have come to define big labor, former federal labor official Linda Chavez says. John Sweeney and other union bosses have tried to portray American capitalism as a nightmare for workers, despite the real-world evidence to the contrary. The AFL-CIO's triumvirate, in addition to Sweeney, includes Richard L. Trumka and Linda Chavez Thompson. Trumka, the union's second-in-command, rose from the ranks as a coal miner in the United Mine Workers of America. Chavez Thompson serves as the AFL-CIO's executive vice president and is third-in-command. She is also a member of the Democratic National Committee that controls the Democrat Party. She rose from the ranks of the American Federal, State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, to vice president before assuming her current position in the AFL-CIO triumvirate. She invited Communist Party members to join the AFL-CIO while purging anti-communists inside the union. The granddaughter of Mexican immigrants and daughter of sharecropper parents, Chavez Thompson is adamant, "We want to defend their right as workers, whether they're documented or undocumented." The AFL-CIO's top troika call themselves a new voice. Their unrelenting focus on the socialist aspects of the Democratic Party are matched only by their viciousness in sweeping away the plea by the 40% of the union's members who are Republican to target how their union dues are spent for political candidates. John Sweeney, the dominant ruler of the new voice, has guided the policy to turn away from the union members' needs, such as higher wages and better working conditions, to the political agenda of socialized health care, abortion rights, homosexual rights, same-sex marriage, welfare rights, opposition to English as an official language of the United States, anti-Christianity, and racial and gender preferences in the workplace. Another aspect of the new voice centers on recruiting and training hundreds of young people as organizers and political activists. Through an AFL-CIO program called Union Summer, youth are indoctrinated with class warfare rhetoric, including the idea that only the working class can end capitalist oppression. These street workers are then turned loose on society as cannon fodder challenging America's democratic traditions and culture. Heather Booth, a radical organizer and activist since the early 1960s, helped develop the methods adopted by the AFL-CIO's Union Summer program. In addition to being a guiding force of the Extremist Association of Community Organizations for Reform, now ACORN, she and her husband, Paul Booth, a founder and former National Secretary of the Students for a Democratic Society, created the Midwest Academy in 1973. The Academy, until it was supplanted by the AFL-CIO's Union Summer, served as a little red schoolhouse for the far-left activists by teaching radical techniques to win local community issues, a focus prescribed by Antonio Gramsci. One of the Academy's graduates, Andrew Stern, is president of the SEIU. The Midwest Academy prepared a 425-page manual, Organizing for Social Change, which is widely used by radical activists as a textbook for direct action. John Sweeney and the Reverend Jesse Jackson have encouraged the supporters to read and take heed of its tactics and other prescriptions for successful activism. The Service Employee International Union, SEIU, boasts nearly 2 million members across the United States and Canada, as well as in Puerto Rico. It is the largest and fastest-growing union in North America. It has more than 300 local affiliates and 25 state councils. Voicing the progressive socialist Marxist call to transform the United States radically, the SEIU's mission is to create a more just and humane society and to improve the lives of their worker and their families. Its members make up a diverse cross-section of working America, long-term care employees, 500,000, public services, 850,000 government workers, public school employees, bus drivers, and care providers. Property services, 225,000 workers who clean, maintain, and protect commercial and residential buildings, and hospital employees, 900,000 of which 40,000 are doctors and 110,000 are nurses. Former New Left radical Andrew Stern told his members at the outset of his days in office that he expected every leader at every level to devote 5 working days this year to political action. As a consequence of this edict, Stern has a seat in the so-called Shadow Democratic Party that is seizing control from legitimate party liberals on behalf of the progressive socialist Marxist movement. Of special concern to Andrew Stern is what he sees as the coming end of employer-based health insurance and defined benefit pensions. Presumably, the fixes to these problems are to transfer the costs to the taxpayers. Stern's tickle list of political wants also includes job security, better schools, affordable energy, an end to global warming, and less environmental impact of a growing world population. One of SEIU's agenda items is to win complete amnesty for illegal aliens, William R. Hawkins writes, to pave the way for their recruitment as left-wing voters. To translate this perspective into terms with Gramsci's formula for cultural transformation, it is to say, illegal immigration is being used as a progressive socialist Marxist tool to transform American society and traditions in ways that will foster the radical left's accession to power. This viewpoint has been suspected for some time, but Mr. Hawkins helps to bring all of the puzzle pieces together in a poignant picture of what Americans might anticipate. Those who want to radically transform the United States need to create a new proletariat, one that is as alienated from American society on class, ethnic, and cultural grounds as leftist intellectuals are alienated on ideological grounds. Drawing more illegal aliens into the country is the strategy for creating such a movement. In an evenly divided electorate, the influx of millions of foreign-born voters skewed towards the political left could be decisive. Thus, behind the unionization of more janitors, kitchen helpers, and day laborers lurks the far more ambitious project of importing revolution. Emphasis added. The American Federation of the State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, represents more than 1.4 million government workers, ranging from child care providers to corrections officers. It is the second largest government employees union. Led by its president Gerald McEntee and secretary treasurer William Lucy, the union is comfortably in the pocket of the Democrat Party. Its political reach is extended through 3,500 local unions in 46 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. These outlying entities are at the end of money pipelines to help Democrat Party candidate positions with regard to issues important to government workers. Linda Chavez wrote in her tell-all book, Betrayal: How Union Bosses Shake Down Their Members and Corrupt American Politics. Alas, this is what happens in the world of modern unionism. The government employee union puts its own power ahead of everything else, the public good, the community's health and safety, even its own members' welfare. Nearly 50 years ago, big labor threw out the idea of primarily looking after its members' interests in favor of expanding its own political power. It was at this time that private sector union membership began declining, and union leaders suddenly looked to government employee unions as a means of expansion. AFSCME held a Democratic presidential forum in Las Vegas in June 2007. More than 2,000 union leaders and members attended the meeting. Democrat candidates for president were all summoned by the caretakers of AFSCME's vast money tree. If the AFSCME spent a few million dollars less on politicians, they could raise member take-home pay by reducing union dues. But since the real issue is ego-enhancing political power for the union elite, the workers and taxpayers alike pay for contributions to Democrat Party candidates. To enhance their chances for success, the AFSCME provides its members with how-to coaching, how to develop support for lobbying, convince elected officials through lobbying, and get the message through to the media. None of this political prostituting is surprising. The AFSCME has long been a player in progressive socialist Marxist politics. It was an early supporter of the nation's largest independent socialist news weekly in these times, a 1980s mouthpiece for the Institute for Policy Studies, which is now published independently. AFSCME promoted in these times to its members as a part of its agenda to foster closer links between union leaders and the Democrat Party. Gerald McEntee has been a long-term influence at the upper levels of the AFSCME. He was elected president in 1981 and again in 2004. Between these top positions, McEntee was vice president of the AFL-CIO and a key leader in its political program. He is a co-founder and board chairman of the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington, D.C., Another co-founder is Roger Hickey, who, along with Robert Borisich, is a co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future. In late 2003, leading up to the 2004 re-election of President George W. Bush, McKinney declared that the AFSCME is going to mobilize the largest and most aggressive grassroots campaign this nation has ever seen. Brenda Stokely, another AFSCME official, explained the union's political participation more candidly. "The first thing we have to do is remind ourselves that we are fighting for socialism. The National Education Association, NEA, and American Federation of Teachers, AFT, occupy a central role in the progressive socialist Marxist application of Gramsci's formula for cultural transformation of America. For Gramsci, penetration of education and weakening student understanding of traditional cultural and societal norms were especially important." S. Stephen Powell reported in his book Covert Cadre in the late 1980s that the Institute for Policy Studies enjoyed close relations with the National Education Association. The National Education Association promotes itself as being committed to advancing the cause of public education. In reality, the NEA controls the education system from preschool to university and a major political player on behalf of the Progressive Socialist Marxist Movement and Democrat Party. With authority to do nearly whatever it wants with the dues of its hapless 3.2 million members, the NEA is high on political power. Its affiliates are present in every state and some 14,000 communities, which allows the NEA to control public schools, taxpayers, parents, families, communities, and other stakeholders in quality public education nationwide. The slogan of the NEA is "Great Public Schools for Every Child." But such a public relations bumper sticker does not make up for the reality that the NEA, like the other progressive socialist Marxist-oriented unions, habitually regard employers as enemies rather than as partners. 50. This NEA orientation should not be surprising since the teachers' union is a member of the AFL-CIO's activist group Jobs with Justice, a national coalition of unions that support anti-corporate worker justice. Campaigns through a variety of pressure tactics, demonstrations, and negative media attention. By July 2004, the NEA had already transferred $3.6 million in the current election cycle and a fundraising drive had collected another $1.57 million. Meanwhile, NEA aligned itself with an ultra-left organization, MoveOn.org, to coordinate Democrat money collection house parties across the nation. This partnership with the Move On political attack dog gives the NEA and insiders seat at the central committees of the George Soros-controlled shadow party ensconced inside the Democrat Party. The National Education Association is also partnered with the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, an affiliate union of the AFL-CIO. Its roots in the progressive movement reach back to the 1920s. The AFT was founded in 1916 and had several communist members during its early years. The federation brings 1.4 million members to the combined 4.6 million educators in NAFT. Owing to its early communist orientation, the AFT has a strong tradition of prosecuting social justice issues. The American Federation of Teachers collectively pursues social values of advancing human rights, opportunity, and social and economic justice. Other socialist values and principles are centered on building a society where all people have fair and decent working conditions, quality health care regardless of income, dignified work and retirement, decent housing, responsive public services, a clean environment, and a government that protects against discrimination and exploitation, and evens the playing field in curbing abuses of concentrated power and privilege. The NEA and AFT, like other unions in the government services conclave, are more concerned with supporting the politics of the Democrat Party and the progressive socialist Marxist movement than they are about caring for their members. Linda Chavez and her co-author Daniel Gray described union leaders' lust for power at the expense of their members, taxpayers, and students. Despite the platitudes the NEA spouts about commitment to improving the quality of our schools and the education that America's children receive, Linda Chavez observes, "The truth is the NEA cares far more about increasing its political power and promoting a liberal, social, and economic agenda than it does about quality education. Politics loom over organized labor. Supposedly, the worker can be better represented through political power to shift the playing field to their advantage. NEA's annual revenue is in excess of $350 million. The American Federation of Teachers collected another $150 million or so. Most of the money goes for the fat cat salaries and benefits for union officials. Sandra Feldman, former president of the AFT, for instance, garnered a total salary and benefits package of $525,735. Hundreds of other union officials at the NEA and AFT earn six-figure incomes. The NEA has one of the largest checkbooks in American politics, Linda Chavez reports. The teachers' unions maintain a monopoly of power over government schools by controlling the Democrat Party. This political machine is fed year after year by millions of dollars siphoned from the union dues paid by the members. This influence money is not intended to benefit teachers in the workplace directly. Rather, the money paves a pathway to corruption. Ultimately, the NEA's efforts are aimed at achieving enough influence in the Congress via members it helped win seats to reorder the priorities of the United States of America. The NEA's executive director, Terry Herndon, tipped his hand in the 1970s when he described the union's primary strategic objective. The ultimate goal of the NEA is to tap the legal, political, and economic powers of the U.S. Congress. We want leaders and staff with sufficient clout that they may roam the halls of Congress and collect votes to reorder the priorities of the United States of America. American syndicalism. Once upon a time in the darkness of deadly nuclear threats during the Cold War, AFL-CIO leaders George Meany and Lane Kirkland supported the U.S. deterrence and defense posture. The AFL-CIO in 2008, led by John Sweeney, a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, is working to create a progressive socialist Marxist America within an overall international socialist labor movement. According to Lowell Ponte, Sweeney is no communist, but he is aligned ideologically with the AFL-CIO's working-class commitment pledge that we produce the world's wealth, that we belong to the only class with a future, that our class will end all oppression. The deal is that the NEA and AFT will help Democrats get elected to Congress, but payback is expected in the form of support for the greater progressive socialist Marxist agenda. Syndicalism is a set of ideas, movements, and tendencies that share the stated aim of transforming capitalist society by means of action by the working class in the industrial arena. Syndicalists use labor unions as their primary means of both overcoming capitalism and ordering society towards the interests of the majority. The United States has already entered a syndicalism shadow world. Radical community state politics. For the Institute for Policy Studies, politics is the common denominator of all activities underwriting its solar system of organizations. Gramsci understood that a revolutionary undertaking in a bourgeois society like the United States could proceed only from a sound philosophical base and an ongoing political involvement. The unique progressive socialist Marxist blend provides the philosophical base, while IPS and its far-left acolytes assure an ongoing political involvement at the community, state, and national levels. According to editor Bernie Horn's commentary in the Progressive Agenda for the State 2008, which was prepared by the Radical Left Center for Policy Alternatives, most Americans are progressive on most issues. But, Mr. Horn adds, most Americans also support traditional conservative principles, limited government, lower taxes, free markets, and personal responsibility. The way out of this conundrum, he suggests, is to alter the balance of power by espousing an attractive progressive philosophy. That is to say, a socialist philosophy. Since progressive is but a euphemism for socialism, the left once again promises a full blast of political denial and deception, propaganda and disinformation in framing the future. By presenting progressive shadows on the wall of Plato's cave, radical leftists hope to deceive Americans and lead them to vote unwittingly for socialist candidates at all levels of government. The Institute for Policy Studies, while not driven by a single philosophical doctrine, has from its inception set into motion a variety of initiatives that would create a decentralized socialist United States. The IPS brand of socialism pushes economic and social planning to the lowest practicable political unit level, the community, and perhaps the city. This translates to an economy that serves human needs first and property second. According to the radical left, large corporations, since they control so many jobs, community welfare, and health and retirement benefits, need to be placed under public control. Two major influences have helped shape IPS socialism policies over the years: Antonio Gramsci's cultural transformation formula and Saul D. Alinsky's radical community organizing methods. Gramsci has been an important influence due to his emphasis on politics, as explained by Karl Box, being concerned with arousing popular passions and as being essential to creating a cohesion to the process of socialist transformation. Politics at the community and state level would help transform fundamental conflicts of class society into revolutionary ones at the national level. Politics of community. Saul Alinsky's method of community organizing was initially shaped in the worker neighborhoods in Chicago and continued to evolve over three decades to include broader geographic areas in the middle class until his death in 1972. His method was based on three principles. 1. Develop a trade union in the social factory, that is to say, use of bargaining, strikes, and struggle to advance community interests. 2. Create a confrontational, power-oriented community organization that is willing to use militant tactics, and 3. Build a grassroots democracy in which indigenous leaders are developed and the people exercise their own self-determination, not the organizers. Some criticized Alinsky's model as being limited to mobilize only about 2% of a targeted community. But Hillary Rodham Clinton dismissed such criticism. In a rather elitist opinion about the people at the grassroots, she stated in her 1969 senior thesis at Wellesley College, "The point is valid, but of little significance since in any organization the leaders are among the most active members, and decision-making necessarily excludes some elements at times." By 1970, Alinsky mused about how much the United States had changed since his early years of radical organizing neighborhoods proximate to the Chicago stockyard neighborhoods. "Since about 80% of Americans were middle class," he said, "that is where the power is located." In order to tap the middle class to fight for the poor, Alinsky asserted that trained organizers, different from the past, were needed. He recognized that economic and social problems are no longer local issues but regional and national ones. To put together a national power organization, one must assemble the local pieces and orient their resolution to higher political action tiers. In a country with a corporate economy, Alinsky asserted, one needs to find the strength to make corporations use that power for the things that need to be done. The poor and minorities need allies. This means finding supporters among the more than 4/5 of Americans who are middle class. You find out what they, the middle class, is worried about, and you organize them around these issues, he said. Alinsky added that people are drawn together by common interests, not because they live near each other. 38 years later, Alinsky's observations provided much of the framework for the 2008 presidential campaign of Barack Obama. The Institute for Policy Studies created the National Conference on Alternative State and Local Public Policies in CASLP in 1974 to spearhead its grassroots politics of community organizing toward a socialism program. The activists recruited included a variety of leftists, identified communists, and other revolutionaries. At the organization's 1975 conference, Sam Brown, a prominent member of the often violent anti-Vietnam War demonstrations in the 1960s, urged radical state officials to press for regulations limiting the size of bank holdings and assets, putting state funds only in banks which agree to make loans to particularly socially desirable goals, and setting up public enterprises, using taxpayers' funds as capital to drive private enterprise out of certain selected areas. As this example shows, the conference provided a means for satisfying Alinsky's revolutionary approach, while at the same time following Gramsci's counsel to generate an arousing of popular passions. Derek Shearer explained at an CASLP conference co-sponsored by Ralph Nader in September 1981 that the title of his recently released book Economic Democracy was meant to hide the reality that local activists would take over local government in order to use the power of the city to control the wealth of the city. He added that it was essential to conceal the true socialist Marxist nature of their program. "I particularly like the phrase economic democracy because it has been referred to by some of my friends as the great euphemism. And while we can't use the S word, socialism, too effectively in American politics, we have found that in the greatest tradition of American advertising, the word economic democracy sells. You can take it door to door like Fuller brushes and the doors will not be slammed in your face." Apparently, economic democracy had a shorter shelf life than Scherer had predicted, for within a few years Stalin's 1930s popular front phrase, progressive, was rehabilitated and became the new code word for socialism. It is often peddled as meaning general progress, not telling Americans it is a shadow puppet from the wall of Plato's cave. In 1984, IPS members Gar Alperovitz and Jeff Foh published Rebuilding American, a blueprint for the new socialist economy. The central question addressed was, what kind of economic policies meet the needs of the new economic era while reinforcing certain values, especially community and fairness, essential to support the kind of economic policies we need? Consistent with both Gramsci's People's Revolution formula and Alinsky's grassroots activism, Alperovitz and Foh presented a dual vision of the principles on which a new political consensus could be grounded. Strategic planning for national economic stability, combined with an emphasis on radical decentralization and local development. For the authors, the differences between liberals and conservatives lies less in their view of the appropriate size of government than in whom government serves. But they miss the real question, how will Americans be best served? By central planning similar to the old Soviet Union's recipe for economic disaster, or through a dynamic life of liberty-enjoying marketeers where free enterprise thrives? S. Stephen Powell writes in Covert Cadre. In economic policy, IPS has launched a many-tiered campaign to foster socialism in the United States, headed by Lee Webb, Gar Alperovitz, Derek Scherer, and Chester Hartman. Since socialism is anathema to Americans, the campaign speaks instead of economic democracy, stage one in IPS's revolution. 20 years later, Gar Alperovitz sounded off again. He offered a new set of numbers, but the same old, stale solutions for ensuring wealth will benefit the vast majority directly. Professor Alperovitz and his close friends at IPS and the Samuel Rubin Foundation just do not get it. Re-engineering the American economy from an open, dynamic free enterprise system tempered by law to a closed, centrally planned public ownership system will lead to a suffocating oppression that will impoverish all Americans. The radical left's grand progressive socialist Marxist system was tried and tested in the Soviet Union and ended up bankrupting the country and driving ordinary people into the ground. As David Horowitz is quoted in the anagram to this book, socialism makes men poor beyond their wildest dreams. Several radical leftist groups are dedicated to bringing the progressive socialist Marxist message to prepare Americans for socialist governance. One of the most important radical organizations dedicated to peddling socialism to Americans at the community and municipal level is the Association of Community Organizations for Reform, now ACORN, and it has close relations with organized labor. ACORN was founded by Wade Rathke, who organized draft resistance for the Students for a Democratic Society in the 1960s. Michelle Malkin reported in June 2008 that ACORN has leveraged nearly four decades of government subsidies to fund affiliates that promote the welfare state and self-reliance. She added that a whistleblower claims that Chicago-based ACORN has commingled public tax dollars with political projects. ACORN members have often bullied social workers violently in pursuing its mandate on behalf of low-income and working-class people. In the 2004 elections, ACORN members were implicated in numerous reports of fraudulent voter registration, vote rigging, voter intimidation, and vote-for-pay scams. In October 2006, for instance, the chair of the St. Louis Board of Election Commissioners reported at least 1,500 potentially fraudulent registration cards had been submitted by ACORN's workers. Similar irregularities occurred in Florida, Missouri, Ohio, New Mexico, and Minnesota. ACORN hit the jackpot of fraud in Washington state when seven ACORN community organizers submitted nearly 2,000 bogus voter registration forms. In recent years, ACORN has received 40% of its funding from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and several foundations, including the George Soros's left-leaning Open Society Institute. Barack Obama was a community organizer for the progressive socialist Marxist ACORN before becoming a practicing lawyer, entering politics, and running for president. The Cities for Progress is one of 15 major projects of the Institute for Policy Studies, an initiative to bring the progressive socialist Marxist message to local governments across the country. This IPS program offers a toolkit, big box reform, Walmart, for use in countering superstores displacing smaller mom-and-pop outlets. A how-to guideline on getting a resolution passed by a local community government. Sample resolutions on no war in Iran and bring the troops home. Propaganda fact sheets with selected data on education, national health, and poverty. And Akora Weiss. Favorite, a United Nations information packet on cutting poverty in half by 2015. Founded in 1968, the Center for Community Change follows Saul Alinsky's grassroots agitation and social change training programs for preparing activists to spearhead leftist political issue campaigns, promote increased funding for social welfare programs, and bring attention to major national issues relating to poverty. Deepak Bhargava, who worked in several positions at Acorn, is president. Among the center's board members are Heather Booth, co-founder and president of the Radical Midwest Academy and close associate of Acorn, and Paul Booth, Heather's husband, who is a founder and former national secretary of the Students for a Democratic Society. Social Policy is a quarterly journal published by the American Institute for Social Justice and the Acorn Institute. It offers its radical social activist readers insight to what is to be done to secure basic structural changes in American society. This translates to strategies for radical reconstruction of American institutions. Wade Rathke, president of Acorn, is editor-in-chief. Another radical leftist activist group is the Planners Network that offers planning tools to resolve the great inequalities of wealth and power in our society. These resource allocation tools are said to be necessary because the private market has proven incapable of doing so. Chester Hartman, a former IPS fellow, serves as chair of the network's advisory committee. Hartman is a longtime advocate of socialist change, not reform. In 1978, Hartman proposed, in an IPS budget priorities analysis that was prepared for 56 members of Congress, to replace the country's private real estate business with a massive public housing program. He estimated that at least $150 billion would have to be added to the budget deficit and further undermine the existing economic system. This would trigger an investment falloff, he said, raising the broader issues of public enterprise, economic planning, and control of the economy inevitably would have to be confronted. Founded in 1954, the New World Foundation offers grants for radical progressive socialist Marxist movements. Among its more notorious recipients have been the Peace Action Network, Cora Weiss, Center for Constitutional Rights, Peter Weiss, National Lawyers Guild, Robert Borisage, The Nation Institute, friend of IPS, American Civil Liberties Union Foundation, friend of IPS, and a variety of union, legal defense, and community action organizations. Hillary Clinton chaired the foundation from 1982 to 1988. During her tenure, grants were delivered to the National Lawyers Guild, a congressionally designated communist front. The committees in solidarity with the people of El Salvador, communist revolutionary insurgents, and Grassroots International, ties to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. These selected progressive socialist Marxist players in the community politics are indicative of the broad range of organizations and individuals striving to do all they can do to transform American culture as a first step in transforming the U.S. political and economic systems. These are Gramsci's mind control guerrillas using every propaganda and disinformation trick in the book to transform America's communities by convincing middle-class Americans that their lives and livelihoods are being placed at risk by corporate giants and a federal government that serves property first and people second. Through unending deceit and deception, these community guerrillas are linked with other mind control insurgents at the state legislatures and federal government. Their aims remain unchanged. Transform American culture to one consistent with the mind control goals of the progressive socialist Marxist movement, convert the U.S. economy to public ownership and control, and eliminate U.S. sovereignty to facilitate a reform of the United Nations toward a borderless world of socialist governance. Radical politics of the state. Progressive socialist Marxists consider the state legislatures as being a testing ground for the newest political debates and assert that legislators are now the vanguard of the progressive movement. In a sense, state legislators serve as a bridge between middle-class Americans and the issues affecting their lives at the community level and the national political arena. The state legislatures pass far more laws than the U.S. Congress, and many of their actions directly affect the lives and livelihoods of the middle class. The power center in America, as Saul Alinsky referred to the American people more than three decades ago. The Center for Policy Alternatives serves as the radical left's support center and idea factory for state legislators. The center provides leadership and training on important progressive socialist Marxist issues, including those that further cultural transformation in preparation for socialist governance. A one-stop radical idea supermarket, the center also serves as a place where state legislators can participate in leadership programs, gain assistance to polish their skills, and gather information on specific progressive socialist Marxist issues. The Center for Policy Alternatives also makes its unique state action network available to progressive legislators, bringing together a means for exchanges between lawmakers from all 50 states. The center's leadership circles bring legislators together in sharing information and strategies from state to state. More than 200 major victories were racked up by progressive socialist Marxist state legislators in 2007. Tim McFeely, the Center for Policy Alternatives executive director, contends that state legislators are now at the forefront of the progressive movement, enacting the nation's most far-reaching, visionary measures. The Shadow Party. Operating from the triple impact of the Frankfurt School's critical theory, Marxist, Antonio Gramsci's revisionist Marxism of cultural transformation as a precondition to achieving political power, and the radicalism of the New Left's continuing focus on the politics of neighborhoods and state legislatures and union political power at the national level, IPS has created an infrastructure, or a solar system of organizations, that promises to bring socialist governance to America. For more than four decades, the Institute for Policy Studies has applied the image-shaping tools of denial and deception, propaganda and disinformation in casting shadows on the wall of Plato's cave. These mind-control efforts have been designed to create a false reality for the American people. Pounded incessantly by propaganda tricks, false images, and denial of truth, many Americans, blinded by the sunlight outside Plato's cave, understandably see only the contrived negative images of traditional culture, societal norms, and contrived historical truths that were spoon-fed to them so carefully by progressive socialist Marxists. The main plot behind the IPS theatrical production of Shadows Cast on the Walls of Plato's Cave was finally given away by Karl Bogg's discussion of Gramsci's Marxism, the ideological cultural struggle and political action, as a part of long-range political strategy, a thoroughgoing cultural revolution that sets out to transform all dimensions of everyday life and establish the social-psychological underpinnings of socialism before the question of state power is resolved. Emphasis added, the plotting and conspiracies were already being hatched by the radical left. While it took advantage of its henhouse of billionaires and millionaires laying golden eggs for use in creating an effective movement for the 2008 presidential election, the progressive socialist Marxists are counting on their community and state-level victories to win the key cultural battles, as IPS Director John Kavanaugh put it. Environmentalism, feminism, and multiculturalism have become mainstream values, and progressive movements have brought attention to myriad injustices. Kavanaugh brags that IPS has been a convener of progressives for years, and that it strengthens social movements with independent research, visionary thinking, and links to the grassroots, scholars, and elected officials. The open question is whether it will be enough to bring them to power in order to socialize and Marxize America. George Soros. Said to be the world's 38th richest man, George Soros possesses about $7 billion in net worth, $11 billion in investments, and his foundations disperse more than $400 million a year for a variety of causes ranging from euthanasia and abortion to legalization of recreational drugs and left-wing political power building. His political philosophy is drawn from some rather balmy ideas about open societies expressed by Karl Popper, under whom Soros studied in 1948 at the notorious left-wing London School of Economics. For Professor Popper, an atheist, nothing was self-evident. Drawing on Popper's teaching, Soros concluded that the U.S. Declaration of Independence, rather than based on so-called self-evident truths, is but a statement of our imperfect understanding of the world around us. Hence, America's founding documents are disposable in what Soros believes is our godless society. Moreover, for Soros, the state can be an instrument of oppression. Soros argues for development of an interdependent world based on the principles of open society. This requires fostering open society within individual countries and international laws, rules of conduct, and institutions to implement these norms. But since nation-states contradict the development of international, open society, the impulse for change must come from citizens living in open societies who recognize a global open society as something worth sacrifice. To create the age of open society, Soros's vision would require terminating U.S. sovereignty, disposing the Declaration of Independence, U.S. Constitution, and Bill of Rights, or at least significant amendments to make them square with open society norms, and reforming the United Nations to facilitate a world socialist governance with the new social-political institutions to enforce its principles, such as the International Criminal Court and civil society organizations, such as CORAWISIS, Hague Appeal for Peace. It should not be surprising that Soros's Open Society Institute lavishes huge sums of cash on U.S. progressive socialist Marxist civil society entities. By fastening himself like a leech to the IPS's progressive socialist movement, Soros's open society dream sucks the life-giving blood from the Gramsci IPS advances toward America's cultural transformation. By his infusion of large sums of money and persuading other plutocrats to contribute as well, Soros is moving toward a takedown of the United States through control of the Democrat Party and its progressive socialist Marxist candidate whose hidden payback agenda is foreordained. Move forward on the Open Society Initiative. Soros made his political move to ally himself with the IPS and their collaborators in forming Shadow Party as the control center inside the Democrat Party. A secret meeting was held on July 17, 2003, at Soros' Southampton Beach House on Long Island. Morton H. Halperin, a longtime IPS collaborator, was present. He had been hired by Soros a year earlier to head the Washington office of the Open Society Institute, a part of the global network of institutes and foundations located in 50 countries around the world. Halperin made a name for himself by waging open war against the U.S. national intelligence agencies. While director of the IPS-oriented Center for National Security Studies in 1974 and the American Civil Liberties Union from 1984 to 1992. A complete list of the wealthy donors present in Southampton, left-wing union leaders, and Democrat Party activists remains unavailable, but among those present were John Podesta and a bevy of other Clintonites, including Jeremy Rossner, Madeleine Albright, Robert Boorstin, Stephen Rosenthal, union advisor, Carl Pope, Sierra Club, Ellen Malcolm, pro-abortion lobby Emily's List, and prominent Democrat donors, Peter Lewis, Progressive Insurance, Rob Glazer, Real Networks, Rob McKay, Taco Bell, and Lewis and Dorothy Coleman, Benson and Hedges Tobacco. When the cabal went public in November 2003 about the creation of the Shadow Party, Soros assumed the position as spokesman. America under Bush is a danger to the world, Soros declared. The 2004 presidential race, he said, is a matter of life and death, and I'm willing to put my money where my mouth is. In the final tally, Soros poured some $27 million into the campaign to win the presidency for John Kerry. He lost. After licking his wounds and completing a damage assessment of what went wrong in 2004, Soros turned to winning the 2008 presidential election through his clandestine shadow party tucked away inside the Democrat Party. Another secret meeting, this one in Scottsdale, Arizona, was held in the spring of 2005. 70 well-heeled potential donors listened intently while George Soros laid out a 5-year plan to create a network of think tanks, media outlets, and training centers to promote his own special blend of progressive socialist Marxist politics. Those at the secret meeting, calling themselves the Phoenix Group, focused initially on 3 main goals: creating progressive socialist Marxist think tanks, training centers for the young progressives, and media centers. Progressive socialist Marxist political power. Thanks to an analysis shared by Bill O'Reilly at Fox News, the American people can have a clearer idea in 2008 as to how their perceptions are being shaped through a combination of propaganda, disinformation, denial, and deceit by the radical left, which has seized control of the Democrat Party. The model is based on Antonio Gramsci's ideas to first prepare the masses for a change in political power by transforming American culture and, As John Kavanaugh at IPS explained, the left has won many battles in the culture war. What makes 2008 ripe for the left's passive seizure of power through the ballot box is the enormous infusion of millions of dollars from George Soros and his tight clique of left-wing billionaires and millionaires who are pooling their loose change to buy the 2008 election on behalf of the progressive socialist Marxists. The big losers in this deal are the legitimate American liberals who favor a larger role of government in solving societal needs. Instead of competing through a fair democratic election, the left has imposed a dictatorship of the plutocrats, brushing Democrat liberals aside in order to win the election by whatever it takes. In this case, both liberals and conservatives lose, while the complexion of American politics becomes forever changed through the progressive, socialist, and Marxist politics of the non-democratic Democrat Party, Center for American Progress. This is a progressive socialist Marxist think tank that operates under the guidance of former Clinton Chief of Staff John Podesta. The center was said to be the official Hillary Clinton think tank, a Clinton White House in exile, or a White House staff in readiness for President Hillary Clinton. Persistent leaks make it clear that Senator Hillary Clinton is in charge of the center's policy direction and its links with Media Matters to counter conservative views. The center's headlines, a progressive think tank dedicated to improving the lives of everyday Americans. It satisfies this challenge, according to the center's annual report, by asking what if, and then answering in ways that define, defend, and advance a progressive vision for America. Democracy Alliance. Founded by Rob Stein, a longtime Clintonite and Democrat Party insider, the Democracy Alliance is all about funding the operations of the shadow party, not only for the 2008 elections, but to realign U.S. politics over the long term. The alliance consists of a loose-knit group of wealthy business and philanthropic leaders who have been hooked by the progressive socialist Marxist message. One may join by invitation only. The partners agree to pay an initial fee of $25,000 and $30,000 in annual dues. They also pledge to give at least $200,000 yearly to progressive groups identified by the Democracy Alliance. When the partners met in October 2005, for example, they decided to distribute $28 million to 9 grantees. Most of the money went to the Center for American Progress and Media Matters for America. In May 2006, the Alliance partners gave another $22 million to 16 groups, including important players in the November local and state elections. Tides Foundation. The Tides Foundation and its legal firewall partner, the Tides Center, work in tandem as a money laundry for those who wish to donate money to the extremist left wing and other causes. Since some people would like to remain anonymous in their giving to contentious programs, the Tides Foundation will pass the donor money through to the designated recipient, less an 8% fee. It is connected to the Shadow Party, since George Soros' Open Society Institute gave more than $13 million to the Tides Foundation/Center from 1997 to 2003. In addition, foundation grants have been made to the Center for American Progress and Media Matters. More broadly, the list of Tides Foundation and Center grant recipients include numerous progressive socialist Marxist groups supporting the Institute for Policy Study Strategy for the Cultural Transformation of America. MoveOn.org. Funded by George Soros, Peter Lewis, Progressive Insurance, and Stephen Bing, Hollywood producer. In its early days, MoveOn.org contributes to the shadow party by drawing real Americans into politics to fight for a more progressive America and elect progressive candidates. In 2006, for instance, the web-based pressure group poured an enormous amount of resources into defeating Senator Joseph Lieberman, a Democrat who apparently was insufficiently progressive. The political pressure group even reached into the depths of Stalinist viciousness in an effort to defeat the Connecticut senator by referring to him as the Jew Lieberman. In 2007, MoveOn.org drew a great amount of criticism for its ad in the New York Times that mocked General David Petraeus as being General Betrayus. MoveOn.org's main contribution to the shadow party is its ability to draw into the progressive socialist Marxist political process an ever-growing number of young Internet activists who contribute to political causes and turn out for protest rallies in large numbers. These are cyber street thugs who swarm designated hate targets and exert significant political pressure to squash all those in their path. Media Matters for America. This is a web-based, propaganda and disinformation center dedicated to immediate political counterfire. Media Matters monitors, analyzes, and corrects what it calls misinformation in the U.S. media. Misinformation is defined as anything that does not conform to the progressive socialist Marxist propaganda line. In many cases, it provides information to cooperating activists, journalists, pundits, and the general public to rebut what it considers to be false claims and to take direct action against offending media institutions. Media Matters, however, faces a significant credibility issue. As David Horowitz and Richard Poe explain, Media Matters quickly acquired a reputation for lockstep partisanship and reckless disregard for the truth. The trouble is that the so-called media watchdog perceives virtually every conservative utterance that finds its way into the major media as a lie, a smear, a slander, or a falsehood. Another problem is the personal credibility of Media Matters president David Brock, a self-confessed liar and gossip peddler in the past. As Rondi Adamson writes for HumanEvents.com, Brock's own past casts a shadow over his current self-proclaimed dedication to truth-telling. Barack Obama. The campaign for Barack Obama's run for president began with enigmatic shadows on the walls of Plato's cave. The image-making included carefully crafted words and brilliant oratory that left many Americans gasping with delight. As the campaign wore on, however, the Barack Obama that was presented to the public was found to be in a significant contradiction to the real Obama. The real Obama is the chosen one for the far-left progressive socialist Marxists. Disciples of the Gramsci left supported Obama's campaign with millions of dollars to fund a massive propaganda and disinformation campaign. In the end, Barack Obama was exposed as a puppet of the far left. An agent of influence for the Gramsci formula of transforming American culture and leading hard-working Americans toward a comfortable embrace with socialism-Marxism. A solution that would make men poor beyond their wildest dreams, David Horowitz. Barack Obama speaks in elliptical words when discussing his background, values, ideals, and general world outlook. He has yet to reveal his real self to assist Americans in deciding whether he would be a good president. He remains a mystery man similar to the stranger that rides into town in Hollywood westerns. Obama would be the man to change the political construct in Washington, a system in the constipated view of progressive socialist Marxists that is controlled by capitalism or corporate America. Obama promises a cultural revolution based on socialist principles. He is the man chosen to Marxize America. The mosaic of Barack Obama that follows is in three parts. Communist influence during his high school years in Hawaii and at college, communist, terrorist, and socialist Marxist ties in Chicago that fueled his rise to political prominence, and black liberation theology rooted in socialism and Marxism. The slivers of information making up a mosaic of the real Barack Obama reveal a common thread that yields insight to his values, ideals, and plans for changing America. Hawaii and college. Barack Obama has been under the influence of communist and socialist Marxists, or what may be called Gramscists, since 1975 and perhaps even earlier. The warm words Obama wrote in his autobiography, Dreams from My Father, about an older black poet identified simply as Frank, turns out to have been Frank Marshall Davis, a longtime member of the Soviet-controlled Communist Party, USA, and a writer for the party newspaper, the Honolulu Record. He was also a close friend of Obama's maternal grandfather and served as a confidant and role model for Barack during his teens. Cliff Kincaid, a fact-finding researcher, uncovered Frank's true identity in discussions with Dr. Catherine Takara at the University of Hawaii. She had known and interviewed Frank Marshall Davis as a part of her own research for a PhD dissertation. She confirmed that from 1975 to 1979, Davis had a significant influence over Obama during the 3 or 4 years that he attended the Punahou Prep School in Hawaii, actually. Obama attended Punahou from the 5th grade through high school. Dr. Takara explained that she had been introduced to Davis by Obama's Caucasian grandfather, Stanley Dunham, who considered Frank Marshall Davis to be a strong black male figure, a man who exerted a positive influence over the young men during his high school years. His Obama's grandfather was one of Frank's closest friends, Takara said. They played chess or cards together. Following his prep schooling and value shaping by Frank Marshall Davis, Obama in 1979 attended Occidental College in Los Angeles for his freshman and sophomore years. He later graduated from Columbia University and Harvard Law School. Occidental College has had a long-time affinity for radical left politics. The California Senate, for instance, linked Occidental to the Communist Party, USA, as far back as the late 1940s. In recent years, the college has had several far-left students and professors supporting the progressive socialist Marxist movement. One-time student Iqbal Ahmad, for instance, was a Pakistani terrorist with French blood on his hands from his days in Algeria with the notorious terrorist Frantz Fanon and had met with Osama bin Laden on more than one occasion. Ahmad served as the first director of the Institute for Policy Studies overseas arm, the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. In the early 2000s, two far-left professors, Derek Shearer and Saul Landau, both boasted close ties with the Institute for Policy Studies. Shearer is an expert in trying to use cover words for socialism so as not to alarm American voters. He recommends using economic democracy rather than socialism. Landau fancies himself as a propagandist for socialism, and he has close personal ties with senior members of Cuba's intelligence service that is very active in the United States. The socialist Marxist environment at Occidental College was ready-made for Obama after his warm relationship with Frank Marshall Davis. It was here that he was involved in the beginning of the hard left's anti-corporation movement. Unsurprisingly, Obama was very comfortable with his Marxist professors, and he participated in many intense discussions with politically active black students, as well as Chicanos, feminists, and punk rock performance poets. To avoid being mistaken as a sellout, I chose my friends carefully, Obama writes in Dreams from My Father. Sellout to what? Given his soaring rhetoric in 2008 calling for change in Washington, it is reasonable to believe Obama meant a sellout to the traditional American system of commerce, free market economics, or, if one wishes, capitalism. It remains a mystery as to how and why Obama jumped from Occidental College to the more prestigious Columbia University in New York and onto Harvard Law School. Was he being groomed for future service to the radical left? Chicago and the rise to political prominence. Barack Obama moved to Chicago and worked for Wade Rathke, a former SDS member and organizer of the National Welfare Rights Organization, who had established ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. Rathke developed a people's platform calling for nationalization and neighborhood control. ACORN's early platform stated, "Enough is enough. We will wait no longer for the crumbs at America's door. We will not starve on past promises, but feast on future dreams." And, according to ACORN's handbook, it would accomplish its goals by grabbing hold of the reins of political power. ACORN in 2008 was a progressive socialist Marxist shining star of the Institute for Policy Studies' Solar System of Organizations. ACORN was also the radical center chosen by Barack Obama for his $1,000 a month street activist experience, a building block for a future in elective office, first in the state of Illinois Senate and then the U.S. Senate. Obama was cultivated and preened for many years to become a stealth candidate for the hard-left progressive socialist Marxists to grab hold of the reins of political power in 2008. According to Hank DeZutter of the Chicago Reader, Obama believes that elected officials could do much to overcome the political paralysis of the nation's black communities. Obama also thinks that government officials can play a critical catalytic role, rebuilding bottom-up democracies that create their hard-won strategies, programs, and campaigns, and that forge alliances with other disaffected Americans. Obama's run for the presidency is to become not just the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but the community organizer-in-chief for affected black communities and its hard-left supporters. Wade Rathke, one of ACORN's founders, is a former SDS member and a protege of George Alvin Wiley, who in August 1967 created the National Welfare Rights Organization. An antecedent of ACORN, the National Welfare Rights Group presented a deceptive front while attacking the viability of the U.S. economy. Its agenda was all about grabbing political power, with the poor being used as unwitting shock troops against the system. The National Welfare Rights Organization served as the model adopted by ACORN. It was at ACORN during Obama's 1983-1987 community organizing that he was steeped in the left's operational activist program of co-opting the disadvantaged. It was at Acorn that Barack Obama was trained and groomed for future political office by former New Left members, including the extremist Students for a Democratic Society, and he was trained how to implement the Cloward-Piven strategy, developed by Columbia University sociologists Andrew Cloward and Francis Fox Piven. The Cloward-Piven strategy seeks to hasten the fall of capitalism by overloading the government bureaucracy with a flood of impossible demands, thus pushing society into crisis and economic collapse. As a direct result of orchestrating a welfare spending crisis in New York City in 1975, just 8 years before Obama joined Acorn, the city was forced to declare bankruptcy and almost pulled down the entire state of New York with it. In 1983, Acorn was a leader in the Cloward-Piven voting rights strategy designed to overwhelm America's poorly policed political electoral system. This is the Acorn of Barack Obama's time with the radical left organization. Acorn's political assaults against the system over the years evolved to include election fraud and enrolling underage, dead, and non-existent people, Mary Poppins, Dick Tracy, Jive Turkey, and others, on the election rolls. In some cases, crack cocaine was exchanged for fraudulent registrations. William Ayers, Obama's neighbor, friend, and co-board member, and his wife Bernardine Dorn were both high-profile weathermen as a result of their terrorist bombing activities, including dynamite explosions at the Pentagon, Capitol Hill, several banks, and a New York police station. For a time, Bernardine, who called herself a communist revolutionary, was one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives from justice. In 1981, Ayers and Dorn turned themselves into the authorities, but their charges were dropped because of prosecutorial misconduct. It seems law enforcement overlooked administrative details in its efforts to capture these America haters before someone else was killed. Neither Ayers nor Dorn apologized for their destructive tactics and placing lives in danger with their explosives. The Weatherman Underground's terrorist tactics may have occurred some 30 or 40 years ago, as Obama plaintively explains, but a photograph of William Ayers stomping on a U.S. flag in August 2001 is depicted in Susan Brody's family circle. It offers clear evidence that William Ayers remains very much a vicious and untrustworthy America hater. Obama tried to wiggle out of his friendly relationship with Ayers during a debate with Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania on April 17, 2008, by saying that what Ayers did 40 years ago when he was 8 years old makes it difficult for him to reject their friendliness. Yet, Obama was 41 years old when Ayers was jumping up and down on the American flag just 6 years after supporting Obama's 1995 run for the Illinois Senate. William Ayers said in an interview with the New York Times in September 2001, just before the September 11th attacks, that it might become necessary to again bomb government buildings. The Obama campaign insists that William Ayers and Bernardine Dorn did not injure or kill anyone. Yet, an informant in the Weatherman terrorist group, Larry Grathwell, testified before the U.S. Senate Internal Security Subcommittee on October 18, 1974. That Dorn had planned and carried out a 1970 bombing that killed a policeman. He also explained how William Ayers described Dorn's actions to his compatriots reflected detailed knowledge of the bombing at a San Francisco police station. A pipe bomb was designed to kill. It was stuffed with heavy metal staples and lead bullets and, according to Grathwell's testimony, Dorn placed it on a window ledge outside the police station. Sergeant Brian V. McDonald died from shrapnel wounds and several other policemen were hit by the shrapnel of pipe pieces, heavy staples, and lead bullets. Ayers and Dorn are members of the string of Hate America communist terrorists whose hatred is drawn from critical theory, Antonio Gramsci, and the New Left of the 1960s and 1970s to the present day. They are part of an aging clan in search of disciples to pass on the torch of tear down this government. The aging radical left has anointed Obama as a disciple of the successor generation that will bring progressive socialist Marxists into the White House and political power. Social justice, as defined by the progressive socialist Marxist left, can be achieved only through confrontation with bourgeois society, including those with free market economies, a Bill of Rights specifying individual freedoms, and democratic governments. A monumental piece of who Barack Obama really is was shown in a private meeting with potential donors in San Francisco. Addressing the challenges he faced in securing the support of working-class voters, Obama told the well-heeled liberals gathered that it's not surprising. that they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy to people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations. William Crystal, a leading intellectual of our time, quickly recognized the historical and dogmatic root of Obama's cling to religion as a reflection of Marx's famous statement on religion. Religious suffering is at the same time an expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the sentiment of a heartless world, and the soul of a soulless condition. It is the opium of the people, emphasis added. Crystal says that Obama let the mask slip, asking what has Barack Obama accomplished that entitles him to look down on his fellow Americans? Obama's comments in San Francisco allowed us to peer into his soul for just a moment. Many were surprised to find that Barack Obama, an elitist, latter-day apostle of the Students for a Democratic Society, the Cloward Piven strategy, and Acorn's voter rights tactics, had been chosen to preach the gospel of Antonio Gramsci's revisionist Marxism. The hard left supports Obama for president in order to create a cultural revolution in America that will enable progressive socialist Marxists to grab political power. Obama gained considerable political notoriety in Chicago from his community organizing, or what might be more accurate to call community Marxizing, and his relationship with the communist terrorists William Ayers and Bernardine Dorn. Illinois State Senator Alice Palmer, a communist, chose Barack Obama in 1995 as her successor. Senator Palmer has been a prominent member of the U.S. Peace Council, a front for the Communist Party, USA, and the World Peace Council, a Soviet front that was operated by the International Department of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. Senator Palmer was hailed in 1986 by the U.S. Communist Party newspaper, People's Daily World, as being the only Afro-American to cover the 27th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Barack Obama never explained to the American people why the Illinois senator, a dedicated communist, chose him to be her successor. The communist connection, however, spilled over into the Illinois Senate and the U.S. Senate, where Obama boasted of having the most liberal, that is to say, very, very far-left voting record in 2007. Following Obama's win in the Iowa Democrat Party caucuses in early 2008, Frank Chapman, another leading member of the Communist U.S. Peace Council, wrote a curious letter to the People's Weekly World, the Communist Party, USA newspaper. Obama's victory was more than a progressive move. It was a dialectical leap ushering in a qualitatively new era of struggle, Antonio Gramsci's formula for cultural revolution. Marx once compared revolutionary struggle with the work of the mole, who sometimes burrows so far beneath the ground that he leaves no trace of his movement on the surface. This is the old revolutionary mole, not only showing his traces on the surface but also breaking through. The old pattern of politics as usual has been broken. It may not have happened as we expected it to happen, violent uprising of the workers to set up a socialist state, but what matters is that it happened. A socialist Marxist ballot box cultural coup d'etat. For the prospective First Lady's part, Mrs. Obama said in her 1985 thesis at Princeton University that she was greatly influenced by Stokely Carmichael. IPS brought the firebrand black nationalist Carmichael to Washington in 1964 for a conference series. A short time later, he turned up in Havana and declared, "We are moving toward urban guerrilla warfare within the United States." He added that, "We have to fight in the United States in order to change the structure of that capitalist society," insisting that we have no alternative but to use aggressive armed violence. Later, Carmichael was named honorary prime minister of the Black Panther Party. Michelle Obama has yet to clarify just what aspects of Carmichael's radicalism influenced her. The so-called godfather of the Obama campaign is said to be James George Aburesk, a former Democrat congressman and senator from South Dakota and the first Arab American to serve in the U.S. Senate. Tom Daschle, another former South Dakota senator and Obama's messenger to Aburesk, is busying himself putting together Obama's transition team to facilitate a smooth transfer of presidential power after his election. During his Washington years, Aburesk often associated himself with the Institute for Policy Studies, Black Liberation Theology. Another peek inside Obama's radical left, beyond liberal, proclivities is reflected by his being steeped in black liberation theology from his 20 years of listening to the hate-filled, anti-white, anti-American sermons by his pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah A. Wright, Jr. instead of God Bless America, the Reverend Wright, Obama's spiritual counselor, preaches Goddamn America. He said that September 11th was America's fault, that it was the country's chickens coming home to roost. More vile anti-America disinformation poured from Wright's mouth about AIDS being invented by the government to keep the black community down. Obama's church had ties with the Nation of Islam and the radical ideas of Louis Farrakhan. The church bulletin has an open space for propaganda by the violently anti-American and anti-Israel-Palestinian terrorist group Hamas. Stanley Kurtz's analysis reveals that a scarcely concealed, Marxist-inspired indictment of American capitalism pervades contemporary black liberation theology. The same theology that provided the foundation for Reverend Wright's sermons at the Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. Author Kathy Shaw Idle explains that black liberation theology combines warmed-over 1960s vintage Marxism with carefully distorted biblical passages. She says that in contrast to traditional Marxism, it emphasizes race rather than class, and it substitutes the Christian notion of salvation in the afterlife. With liberation on earth, courtesy of the establishment of a socialist utopia. James Cohn, the leading theorist of black liberation theology, posits a black Jesus and sees whites as the devil. In the final analysis, this framework underlies the rants from the pulpit at Chicago's Trinity United Church of Christ that led Reverend Wright's African-American parishioners to a socialist fantasy land. James H. Cohn is the founder of black liberation theology, and Reverend Wright has acknowledged Cohn as being the basis for Trinity's perspective. These are the views that Barack Obama and his family internalized for nearly 20 years, and it is reasonable to conclude that their perspectives of America and their frameworks for future policies may well have been shaped in part by Cohn's thought. Cohn's radicalism, Stanley Kurtz explains, rejects anything short of total social revolution. Since Cohn believes white society cannot improve, and blacks are enduring a perpetual de facto Holocaust as long as they stay inside it, revolution is the only answer. Capitalism, Cohn believes, must be replaced by some sort of democratic socialism. Cohn says, I do not think that racism can be eliminated as long as capitalism remains intact. He adds that together black religion and Marxist philosophy may show us the way to build a completely new society. Cohn's perspectives on black theology are rooted in Reverend Wright's speeches arguing that white America's corporate dollars turn middle-class blacks into slaves. Attacks on capitalism are normal fare at Reverend Wright's sermons and are found in many of his messages. The fact of the matter is that Wright believes that American capitalism is both the underlying cause of the poverty and suffering of black people abroad, and the sinfully tempting apple that lures deluded middle-class blacks to enslave themselves to corporate white America. Obama joined the Trinity United Church of Christ in 1992, steeping himself and his family in a polarizing but undeniably popular combination of black power fulminating, racial separatism, and community outreach. Under the guidance of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, the Trinity Church adopted a black value system that emphasized black community, the black family, a black work ethic, and urge support for an all-black leadership. Jacob Laskin explains that this led to another element in the black value system calling for ceasing pursuit toward middle-classness. Laskin reported that this view depicted American society as an enemy of black people and it stood accused of killing them off directly and or fostering a social system that encourages them to kill off one another and placing them in concentration camps, and restructuring an economic environment that induces captive youth to fill the jails and prisons. Reverend Wright's voice in his sermons and speeches became one of political extremism and racial separatism. When examining the disturbing core assumptions of black liberation theology, one can clearly see the echo of the radical socialist Black Manifesto that was adopted in April 1969 during the National Black Economic Development Conference and presented a month later to the congregation of the Riverside Church in New York City. It states in part, "Our fight is against racism, capitalism, and imperialism, and we are dedicated to building a socialist society inside the United States where the total means of production and distribution are in the hands of the state, and that must be led by black people, by revolutionary blacks who are concerned about the total humanity of this world." Emphasis added. The reality is that Obama has been a member of Chicago's Trinity United Church of Christ for 20 years, regardless of whether he sat in the pew with his family every Sunday taking in the lies and distortions pouring from Reverend Wright's pulpit. Obama's values and views certainly were shaped partially by Reverend Wright's poisonous anti-white rants. It is impossible, Thomas Cushman, professor of sociology at Wellesley College, says, to imagine that he could not have known about them. In church, everyone knows what the pastor says, either by direct observation or word of mouth. Professor Cushman concludes from this reality that a man who chooses someone like Reverend Jeremiah Wright to be his spiritual mentor simply lacks the good judgment necessary for high office, because it suggests a close relationship to a kind of self-serving and coarse black liberation theology. Moreover, Fred Siegel adds that the presidential candidate Barack Obama never apologized for his own failings and never having chastised Wright. Obama, for instance, told the Sojourners Religious Group, a far-left conclave closely associated with the Institute for Policy Studies, that, "I believe in the power of the African-American religious tradition to spur social change. Because of its past," he said, "the black church understands in an intimate way the biblical call to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and challenge powers and principalities, or replacing Christian salvation with liberation on earth." He continued by explaining that in its The African-American Church's Historical Struggles for Freedom and Human Rights, "I was able to see faith as more than a comfort for the weary or a hedge against death, but rather as an active, palpable agent in the world, as a source of hope." Obama's strained Christianity reflects more of a belief in finding liberation on earth than a transcendental belief in God. Christianity in the hands of the radical left is one that embraces Antonio Gramsci's formula for a massive cultural revolution in America, one leading to socialism Marxism. It is a deluded Christianity whose transcendent beliefs are replaced by immanent ones. The Institute for Policy Studies and its Solar System of Organizations have a major influence on policymaking in the Congress, many state legislatures, and municipalities. With its international reach to Europe and Russia through the Gorbachev Foundation, constellations of the Institute's shining stars also influence U.S. foreign policy. With the exception of President Jimmy Carter and, to some degree, Bill Clinton, the progressive socialist Marxist movement has been shut out of the White House. The IPS directors and members of their network are drooling to once again have one of their acolytes as President of the United States. With the assistance of George Soros and his gang of fellow plutocrats, the far left has taken over the Democrat Party by developing fronts inside its shadow party secreted within the Democrat Party. It was from here that the radical left placed all its chips on Barack Obama. Obama promises a vague image of real change when he is elected president. But real change is defined through his long relationship with communists and progressive socialist Marxists and peddlers of black liberation theology. Senator Obama is a shadow puppet for the Institute for Policy Studies' drive toward creating a new social construct that embraces Antonio Gramsci's formula for a socialist Marxist economy and a government, exerting mind control over the American people through a comprehensive cultural revolution. In the real world, Barack Obama is the progressive socialist Marxist soldier hiding inside a Trojan horse cast onto the walls of Plato's cave. He is the one who, when elected, will slip out of the radical left's wooden horse to open America's gates to a horde of socialists, Marxists, and assorted communists intent on swarming the federal government and carrying out a family-destroying, religion-busting, freedom-infringing cultural revolution, and an extended political dominance over the entire country. They will seek to Marxize America.